Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Nice.
Oh. Nice mashed potatoes you guys got out here.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else the Iditarod and those Iditarod teams are out there taking their 24-hour breaks. We'll explain more about that. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. That was a happy Brent Sass pulling his dog team into the Cripple Checkpoint Wednesday in first place, halfway into the 1,000-mile Iditarod Trail sled dog race. And welcome to Thursday from our specific location in space-time. As it is. Yesterday, we were talking about catching up, and today we're talking about resting up. Mushers and their dog teams are now either in the middle of their mandatory 24-hour layovers or whatever your own relation to them is in space-time, coming off their 24s if they decided to take them earlier. In that case, they're probably back out on the trail. Those would be the teams of mushers like Richie Deal, Aaron Burmeister, Mile Porcild, Travis Beals, Jesse Holmes, Paige Drobny, Michelle Phillips. The list goes on. And all the folks who stopped for 24 hours plus their time differential earlier. And remember, because the teams started in 2-minute intervals in Willow, not all at the same time, there's not a big mass start. And there is one race clock ticking for all of them, that time differential gets added to their 24-hour layover. So the musher who started last can leave their 24 at exactly 24 hours. The musher who started before them is 24 hours plus 2 minutes, so on and so forth, all the way on up to the musher who started first, who has the longest time differential to wait. Now what happens is all of those mushers who've already 24'd, they'll be closing in on the mushers who decided to take their 24-hour breaks farther down the trail. And where they pass those mushers is really where the race is going to set up here in the last half. The mushers at the front, for now, as I'm recording this, still technically in the lead, are Brent Sass, who we just heard from, and Dallas Seavey, who is 3 hours behind Sass and second into the Cripple Checkpoint. Video from Iditarod Insider from Sass's arrival Wednesday afternoon showed him smiling as he greeted the checker and commented on the powdery snow.
Nice mashed potatoes you guys got out here.
Sass, who trains mostly at a remote homestead north of Fairbanks in Eureka, won his choice of $3,000 worth of gold nuggets or a smartphone with a year of free service. While putting booties on his dogs at the prior checkpoint in Ophir, Sass told the Iditarod Insider that he's running his own race and not focusing on his closest competition, Dallas Seavey. He says he's made that mistake before.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to do, especially late in the game. Right now, there's no excuse for it because it's so early in the race still. And the race hasn't started yet, really.
Sass is gunning for his first Iditarod victory while Seavey is trying to get his sixth. That would be a new record. Seavey and his 12-dog team arrived about 3 hours behind Sass at Cripple, where he also opted to take his 24-hour rest.
Hi. Welcome to Cripple.
Thanks.
We're going to be here for long-term parking.
Right, 24?
If I needed to say that, yeah.
And Iditarod teams are scattered across checkpoints for their mandatory 24-hour breaks. A bunch of them stopped earlier at the checkpoint in McGrath, a community roughly a third of the way into the 1,000-mile race. Alaska Public Media's Jeff Chen reports on the snowy scene there.
Iditarod musher Sebastian Dos Santos Borges was a little surprised Wednesday afternoon with how similar the weather in McGrath was to his hometown in France.
It's the same snow like in France here in McGrath, so it's crazy. It's very wet.
Borges was among the teams taking their 24-hour stop at the checkpoint. Temperatures were in the mid-30s, comfortable for humans, but warm for sled dogs. Snow melted as it hit mushers' raincoats. They walked between the dog yard and the airplane hangar throughout the day, cycling through feeding their dogs, feeding themselves, and resting. Borges says he's been working hard out on the trail to help his dogs through the snow. He got off the sled runners and ran alongside his team.
I run every day, every hour, every minute. I use a skip wall too, and I run to help my dogs and And when I stopped to run, you know, my dogs turned to see what's happening, you know.
His team was nodding off Wednesday afternoon, while nearby, another team was wide awake and standing up. The dogs belonged to Lev Schwartz, who was having some regrets about his decision to take his long rest here.
I was mistaken. I was severely mistaken. I should have gone a cripple. But, I mean, it's okay for them. They're fine. Like, rest never hurts them. I just think I gave up a couple positions by not pushing. But and that's racing.
Cripple is more than 100 miles down the trail. It's a remnant of the Gold Rush era. No one lives there. It's quiet. And that's a factor that pushed some top mushers like Brent Sass and Dallas Seavey to blast through McGrath and head that way. Aside from regret, Schwartz had other issues too. He says his male lead dogs were distracted by two female dogs on his team who were in heat. Also, he hadn't gotten much sleep, but he doesn't like to while racing.
If I just keep my body in this weird hour or two nap thing, like, I just seem to be able to do it for longer.
Iditarod rookie Joe Taylor was taking his 24-hour break in McGrath too. As he finished feeding his dogs, he says despite challenging conditions earlier in the race, he was feeling surprisingly good.
I did not imagine I'd be this happy at this point. This is now the farthest I've ever gone with a dog team.
Taylor says it felt like the, quote, spiciest trail was behind him. Twisty and windy Dalzell Gorge, check. Barren trail into Nikolai, check. That leaves a different challenge ahead. Monotony.
I think, like, maybe what I'm dreading is as we get farther into the race, the dogs are going to lose a little bit of speed, and we're going to be on, you know, the river for quite a few miles and on some flat trail. And I think I have to embrace the kind of mindless slog that it's going to become over the next few hundred miles.
Taylor says he'll just be really excited to make it to the coast. At the Iditarod checkpoint in McGrath, I'm Jeff Chen.
That story from Jeff Chen in McGrath yesterday. We had some news late last night that Anya Rodano of Talkeetna had scratched from the race in Nikolai. I believe that was about 9 p.m. Wednesday. And all the race said about that was that she had decided to scratch in the best interest of her team. So there are now 48 teams. We started with 49. And running in 48th place, way at the back, we call that the Red Lantern Musher, is Kaylin Davis. To hear more about Kaylin Davis, it's Throwback Thursday, so we're going to throw it back to Nikolai and Lex Trinan.
Rookie Kaylin Davis was more than 3 hours behind the next team when she pulled off the banks of the Kuskokwim River into Nikolai, but she had a surprise waiting for her.
And I made this, and this is for you.
Wait, really?
Oh my gosh.
Olin Petruska, a local artisan, hands Davis a pair of hand-sewn beaver mitts. Davis can hardly believe herself.
Thank you so much. That's you. Can I give you a hug?
Davis says she didn't plan to be in the very back of the pack at this point in the race, but she's also not too concerned about it. She says her dogs were exhausted and needed an extra long rest out on the trail after the tough run through the farewell burn area. For her, the run included a run-in with a few bison. A herd was introduced into the area in the 60s and occasionally crosses paths with mushers.
I have no experience with bison. I don't really know how to react or, like, what do you make noise? Like, what scares them away? I don't know. Probably should have researched that before coming out here.
She says the bison quickly jumped off the trail and she continued without incident. Still, Davis was cheerful and her team looked fresh when it arrived in Nikolai, including a dog she had rescued as a sickly one-year-old and nursed back to her Iditarod team. She says the dog, Zeke, even led through some of the challenging overflow sections when other dogs faltered.
I put him up in lead and he started jumping up and barking and I said, okay, let's go. And he just like single-handedly dragged the whole team across the water.
As for coming into Nikolai at the back of the pack, she says she didn't even realize until she got there. She says she doesn't mind being in the back, even when it means there aren't others behind her to check in if something goes wrong.
I don't ever mind being out here by myself. It's really relaxing. It's nice, you know, you never really feel alone because you've always got the dogs and stuff, so.
And now that she's at the checkpoint, she says her dogs look like they're ready to catch back up to the pack. Reporting in Nikolai, I'm Lex Trinan.
That's right. Kaylin Davis has that dog Zeke that she rescued from an animal shelter. He had really bad skin, but she got him healthy, washing him with an oatmeal bath, even though she doesn't have running water in her cabin in Fairbanks. But she made it happen, and he appears to be doing well. He's leading her team in the Iditarod. Such a cool story. That was kind of our first dog profile for this year. Wait, did I just say dog profile? Yes, I did. Let's get to today's dog of the day, the DOD. It's the captain of Alberta musher Aaron Peck's team, Tundra.
You know, I've mentioned Tundra a lot lately because he is 8 years old now, and he's been, you know, it's his fifth Iditarod, and he's, you know, finishes everything he starts, and he's like he's a leader, but I can't have him in lead too much because he's kind of unpredictable up there. But I call him the team captain, and he's a beauty. Like, I owe him a lot. I'm just so grateful for his contribution over the last few years and getting to know him every time and, you know, being such a solid rock in the team. So Tundra, this is for, you know, might be his last one at 8 years old, but yeah. Even though he's still running like a pup. Yeah.
You know. And you said he's, I forget the word, but you said inconsistent or something?
Oh, in lead, Tundra can, if he's in lead, he'll have a mind of his own. If you come to a fork in the road and you say, gee, and he'll take it like a pro, but then at the very last second, he'll like, oh no, I'll go back over there to the left side, and he'll just like jump back over, like he second guesses the command, or like he just kind of just switches on you on a dime. Or if he's running down the trail and he sees a skidoo track over there to the right, he'll be like, oh, the grass is greener over there, let's go over there. And then he'll take the whole team into the deep snow just like that. And it's like, oh, what are you thinking, Tundra? Don't do that until I, you know, I need to give the command, you know, as the leader of the team. Yeah, so he's funny like that. So I just tend not to run him in lead too much.
Yeah. How much does he weigh?
He's 55, 60 pounds. He's a perfect size, perfect build Iditarod dog.
That was musher Aaron Peck talking to our Lex Trinan at the Iditarod ceremonial start in Anchorage about Peck's dog Tundra, the captain of the team. You heard him say this will likely be Tundra's last Iditarod, his fifth, and it's Peck's ninth Iditarod after his highest finish in last year's race at 14th place. But how do these mushers get into the sport to begin with? Let's throw it back again to musher beginnings for today's listener question.
Howdy, my name's Olive. I'm from Conroe, Texas, and I have always loved the Iditarod and been fascinated with mushing. And I was just wondering, how do you start getting into something like mushing? Because, I mean, being born from Texas is not really anywhere you can go to learn how to mush dogs, but now I'm living up in Canada and I would love to get a start on it. Thank you.
I suspect it's different for everybody, probably with some commonalities, like a love of dogs. And then at some point they try dog mushing, maybe out on a tour, and they get bitten by the bug, as many mushers describe it. It really is a unique thing, and it's hard to describe why dog mushing grabs people like that. But there's this romanticism about it. There's, of course, the dogs, and it's just a quiet, pretty pleasant way to travel over the land. I definitely would recommend it, even if you're not an aspiring long-distance dog musher. It's just kind of a fun thing to do. And hey, you know, maybe even come up to Alaska and go on a tour with one of these dog mushers tour companies. They've taken huge hits during the pandemic. We had tourism pretty much completely shut down 2 summers ago, and then last summer was a bit reduced too. So a lot of those dog mushing tours are hoping that people will come back to Alaska and go out on a tour with them. And hey, maybe you'll get bitten by the dog mushing bug yourself. And for those who really are interested in getting into the sport, that lifestyle, really, it's even more than a sport, really, for a lot of people. An aspiring dog musher will seek out a veteran Iditarod musher or other veteran musher to work with or to work for and learn from by becoming a handler. Like I said, a lot of them have tour businesses, so they need employees that would be dog handlers to help take care of the dogs and, frankly, to help take care of the tourists. If you're curious about that, you weren't the only one.
Hello, this is Alice from Greensboro, North Carolina. First of all, I just wanted to say that y'all are my favorite podcast, and I look forward to hearing you every single year. But I've been wondering what the scoop is on the handlers. So, like, what's their story? How do they get into it? What do they do during the race? And how does someone become a handler?
Thanks for that question, Alice. And just so everybody knows, yes, flattery will get you on the Iditapod, so thanks for that too. We sent both of your questions to Sean Underwood at Jeff King's Husky Homestead, where they do tours in the Denali area. Underwood started as a handler there and took King's A-team on the Iditarod in 2020 after King withdrew right before the race for a medical issue. We've talked about that before in past episodes of the Iditapod. Underwood didn't actually make it to Nome that year, though, and scratched, but he returned in 2021 and completed the pandemic-altered out-and-back course. So if he's been to Nome, it hasn't been as an Iditarod racer, and I wonder if someday we will see Sean Underwood make another shot at that. Anyway, Sean Underwood's originally from Georgia, so like Texas, not exactly known for dog mushing, and he has a really good perspective on this.
Hello, this is Sean Underwood. I've been working with sled dogs as a handler and musher for 5 or 6 years. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, so I'd never dreamed of finding myself in this situation, but I came up to Alaska to get a summer job and ended up researching some kennels that needed some extra helping hands. And so I you didn't have to look hard to find a job. It's not that hard to find a position that's available, but you are sacrificing a lot to do it. You don't really have free time to do anything else. You're not going to be paid a living wage. You're basically get a grocery stipend and a rent, which is in itself a little bit of a wage. And you find yourself in that world of mushing. You start to learn how to work with sled dogs and, you know, eventually how to run them and how to feed them and just learn the basics. And you go on training runs, you learn how to camp out the dog. And, you know, after you put in a year or two or three, depending on how you're doing, you can participate in a smaller, shorter race. And if you like that, you keep on kind of following the path that is revealed to you. And sometimes it takes, you know, if 3 years, if you have, you know, enough money, you can get your run an Iditarod and 2 years after learning how to mush. But that's if you can pay. You know, if you can only pay with your labor, then you are going to maybe sacrifice a few extra years of preparation and getting ready to do that. And, you know, the opportunities are, I got lucky, I think, when I got to run the Iditarod, that opportunity kind of fell into my lap. And so for some people I've known, it takes them 7 years to get their first opportunity because they, you know, maybe didn't find the perfect fit until a few years later. The short answer, how do you get into it? You come up to Alaska and start knocking on some doors, and someone's going to answer and give you a job.
Sean Underwood answering listener questions for the pod. How about one more throwback for this Thursday? Here is Sean Underwood in 2020, a little while before his first ceremonial start, his only one actually since last year's was canceled. This is, again, from 2020 in downtown Anchorage.
Do you feel like you have an advantage with this awesome hair that will keep you warmer, maybe?
Oh, man. You know, it's been fun growing out my hair. I grew up with a buzz cut or, you know, a comb. My dad combed my hair every day, every morning when I was, you know, in elementary school. And it's been fun growing it out. Didn't know it was going to get this curly. And
you didn't know, huh?
I didn't know. It's straight when it's short. And so I grew it out, and after about 3 inches, it starts to get really, really curly. But, yeah, I love the flow, and it does help me, you know, keep warm, and it collects all the snow, and it's kind of like having an extra ruff, you know.
I had to ask you that. I saw your picture of the ADN, and I was like, that guy's got awesome hair.
Yeah, somebody on social media was like, the last minute rookie might be the winner for best hair, and I was like, all my dreams. No.
Is it like part of your transition from going from like Georgia to
this is exactly how a Georgian would think. You're going up to Alaska, you see, you know, these pictures of these rugged individuals, and the first thing I thought was, I need to grow my beard out and I need to grow my hair out. And so I did those things, and it was from a good, actually Jeff's daughter Ellen, she's always like, Sean, just fake it till you make it. So I showed up here and I got my hair grown out and a beard grown out so that maybe all these hard Alaskans would see me and not think I was so green. So after a few years, I don't need the hair as much to to, you know, disguise myself. I feel pretty competent out here.
Sean Underwood there, still one of my favorite clips from a ceremonial start. You may remember that from an Iditarod 2 years ago. Well, all of our past episodes and past Iditarod coverage, heck, lots of stories about the goings-on in Alaska generally, are at alaskapublic.org, as well as that extended interview with Upayauk Raitan. We have a lot of fresh coverage from this year's race at alaskapublic.org, including tons of photos, stories, dog profiles, a sign-up for our special Iditarod newsletter, and more, all curated by Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon, who is turning the cranks and throwing the levers that make our website go. As always, big thanks to her and our reporters out on the trail, Lex Trinan and Jeff Chen. That is about all the time we have for today. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode of the Iditapod. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
It's not. It's fun. I'm out here for my own entertainment, trying to make a buck to pay for their dog food. This race is an incredible event. I absolutely love it. I love driving dogs, probably more than anything else I've ever done in life. But it has no bearing on the rest of the world, so.
You feel like it's irrelevant?
Is it? No, it's relevant to those who are interested in it. But in the grand scheme of things, is anything relevant? Did you tell me to keep it clean?
I did.
Why?
Because that's not typical for you. He's recording you. Recorder is on.
Yeah, but he's going to be able to edit it.
Yeah, bleep, 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 bleep.